Lecture 15, The Federal Budget and Fiscal Policy.
With this lecture, we're going to shift the focus of our discussion of macroeconomics. What we've done through the previous four lectures is work through major goals of macroeconomic policy. That is to say, growth, inflation, unemployment, and a sustainable trade balance. What we want to do in this lecture and the next one is to talk about the major tools that we have to try and accomplish those goals and sort of spell out the connection between tools and goals. The particular focus of this lecture is on fiscal policy, and fiscal policy is just the economist's word for talking about policy with regard to spending and taxes. What I want to focus in on particular is the federal budget. The federal budget in the late 1990s is about $1.7 trillion. Now, to put that in some perspective, global gross domestic product, if you add up the economies of all the countries in the world, is about $27 or $28 trillion. So, if you do the long division, 1/16 of the global economy is collected and spent by the federal government. 1/16 of all of the world's economy. So when we think about fiscal policy, we're talking about the U.S. government in a direct way through its taxing and spending power, distributing a sizable proportion of everything that's out there on the globe. Let's look at both the spending side and then the taxing side. The numbers and the proportions I'm going to describe here are based on the fiscal year 1998 budget, but I'm afraid that they are based on that budget sort of partway through the early part of the year, and these budget numbers always get adjusted somewhat up, somewhat down over time. So again, as in earlier examples where I give particular numbers or particular proportions, the focus that you should have shouldn't be on the exact number. The focus should be on the overall structure of federal spending, the structure of how these programs fit together. Let's look at the spending side of the budget first. The spending side of the budget in 1998, fiscal year 1998, totaled about $1,670 billion, or roughly $1.7 trillion. Most of that can be crammed into four categories. Those four categories are defense spending, which was 16% of the total, Social Security spending, which was 23% of the total, health spending, which includes mainly Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor, which is 20% of the total, and interest payments on past federal borrowing, which were 14% of the total. Add those four categories together, and you have 73% of all federal spending. So when you think about what the federal government does, what fiscal policy does, if you want to think of it in that way, what you really should say to yourself is 3/4 of it is defense, Social Security, health, and interest payments on past federal borrowing. The entire rest of the federal budget is 27% of the federal budget, and that entire rest includes the following. It includes international spending, space, science, energy, natural resources, agriculture, commerce, housing, community development, transportation, education and training, veterans benefits, legal things, the expenses of government. So all the rest of the federal government, once you get past those four big categories, is really little bits and pieces that add up to 27% of all federal spending. What are some of the patterns that we've seen in federal spending over time? There seems to be a widespread belief out there that federal spending has really increased dramatically over the last few decades. But actually, overall spending seems to be up a lot less than people think. I think the most useful way of putting federal spending in perspective is to look at spending as a percentage of gross domestic product. If you think about spending as a percentage of gross domestic product, what you're really doing is taking total spending, dividing by the size of the economy, and that kind of puts the spending in perspective, that as the economy gets bigger, so does spending to some extent, but we kind of look at the proportion between those two. And if you look at that, what you see is that in the early 1990s, spending in proportion to gross domestic product was about 21-22%. And by the late 90s, it had fallen to about 20%. Now, if you go back to some years earlier in this century, particularly in, say, World War II, the government was, during wartime, spending 45% of gross domestic product in 1943 and 1944. But even after the war, if you look at 1953, the government spent 21% of GDP. It also spent 21% of GDP in 1968, 1976, 1977. In fact, in the early 1980s, the government spent 24% of GDP in 1982 and 1983. So if you look at spending as a percentage of GDP, we're actually down some from where we were in the mid-1980s. And I gave you some sort of exceptional years. On average, we're a little bit higher than we were in the 50s and 60s. But federal spending has not shifted or increased dramatically in the way a lot of people think. In fact, if anything, it's off a little bit, down a little bit in the later part of the 1990s. Why has that happened? What's changing in the composition of federal spending? Well, one of the big changes is that defense spending has declined dramatically. If you go back to the 1950s, when Dwight Eisenhower was talking about the military-industrial complex, defense spending at that time was 10% of GDP. One-tenth of the entire economy was defense spending. But in the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, it was down to about 7%. The 1970s, defense spending was more like 5% of GDP. It goes up a little bit with Reagan's defense spending hikes in the early 1980s, but then after about 1986 or so, defense spending keeps drifting down and drifting down, and now defense spending is less than 4% of GDP overall. So one constraint for pressing for lower federal spending over time has been lower defense spending, and that sag in defense spending over time. In general, there's been kind of a trade-off. Defense spending has sunk and sunk and sunk. However, social spending, like Social Security and health care spending, has increased and increased over time. And so those two have sort of been balancing each other out, kind of moving against each other over the last few decades. Interest payments have also boosted spending quite a bit. If you look at interest payments right now at the end of the 1990s, interest payments are something like $240 billion a year. It's remarkable sometimes when people sort of say things like, well, you know, those deficits in the 1980s, they really weren't such a bad thing. Sure, we had budget deficits in the 1980s, but it all worked out okay. Well, now we're paying the interest on those deficits, and the interest is $240 billion a year. As I said before in another context, whatever your social desires are, it's probably true that with $240 billion a year, you could go a long way toward paying for those kinds of programs, whatever the programs are, or tax cuts that you might favor. And past borrowing, forcing us now to make interest payments on that past borrowing, has really removed a lot of the flexibility that we have to make those payments. In fact, it appears likely that if defense spending keeps going down a little bit and interest payments stay high, that toward the end of the 1990s, we will be paying more in interest on our past borrowing than we were paying for the entire defense budget. So that's one of the costs of high federal borrowing over time. Let's look at the tax side. On the tax side of the budget, the total tax take at the beginning of 1998 fiscal year was expected to be about $1,660 billion. That is just about $10 billion less than spending. So the prediction was at that point that we would have almost an exactly balanced budget. Over the course of the year, what seems to have happened is that over the course of the year, the economy's done very well, and as a result, we've brought in more tax revenue than we expected. So tax take has been higher than expected, and because of the very strong economy, we've been able to spend less on health programs and on other kinds of programs than we would otherwise have needed to spend. So by the end of the 1998 year, it looks like we'll actually have something of a budget surplus, and that surplus may stay with us a few years. But again, my point here is not to focus on a particular year. My point is to focus on the overall structure of this money that's coming into the federal government. And that structure doesn't change a huge amount year to year. Where do the taxes for the federal government come from? Well, 46% of the tax take of the federal government is individual income taxes. That is that 1040 form that you pay on April 15th. 12% is corporate income taxes, or to put it a little bit differently, the corporate profits tax, which corporate income is just a nice way of saying corporate profits. 34% of all the money taken in by the federal government is social insurance taxes. And social insurance is the nice word for the payroll taxes, which cover Social Security and Medicare. excise taxes. Excise taxes being taxes on particular goods, mainly in the case of the United States, gasoline, cigarettes, and alcohol, bring in 3% of federal spending. And those categories together, individual income tax, corporate income tax, social insurance tax, and excise taxes, are 95% of all the money the government takes in. The other 5% is little categories like estate taxes, that is the taxes on people who've died and their estates, things like customs fees and some other kinds of little fees that the government collects. What is it that's sort of odd when people look at this, or what jumps out when you look at this kind of a table? Well, first of all, I think that, again, we have this tendency to believe that taxes have been going up and up and up over time. But if you look at the long-term historical perspective, it's just not that clear that that's true. Over a long period of time, tax receipts have been about 19% of gross domestic product. So I'll give you a few years where taxes were 19% of gross domestic product. They were 19% in 1952, 1953, 1969, 1970, 1979, 1980, and 1987. Usually, over that time, tax receipts tended to be a little less than that 19% of GDP, but it was almost always between 17 and 19% of GDP. With the economy doing so well in the 1990s and a healthy economy generating more tax revenue, the percentage of the economy taken up by federal taxes has been climbing a little bit, and it now seems to be above 20% of GDP, approaching 21%. But again, when you think about overall over four decades, this kind of movement from a little bit below 19% of GDP to a little bit above 19% of GDP hardly qualifies as the enormous, shocking, striking trend that a lot of people are expecting when they look at federal taxes. The real big growth area in taxes over this time has really been the social insurance taxes, that is, the payroll taxes for Medicare and Medicaid. In fact, and this is one of these facts that a lot of people aren't so aware of, it shocks a lot of people when they look at this sort of chart on federal taxes and they realize that the individual income tax, which a lot of us think of somehow as the primary basic federal tax, which really raises most of federal revenue, that the individual income tax brings in less than half of all federal taxes. And when you think about social insurance and payroll taxes, those have just been edging up and edging up and edging up year after year after year after year. In fact, again, a little known fact, that for more than half of the people in the United States, the amount that they pay in the payroll tax for Social Security and Medicare is more than they pay in their individual income tax. For most people, the payroll tax, for more than half the people in the United States, the payroll tax is a bigger tax for them than the income tax. While the payroll taxes, the Social Security taxes, have crept up and up, the corporate tax and excise taxes have slid down and down. If you go back to the 1950s, you'll see that the corporate taxes, instead of being perhaps 12% of GDP, were more like 15 or 20% of GDP, and the excise taxes were more like 8% of GDP. Now, that sort of a change is the sort of thing that makes you go, why is it exactly, or is it a good thing, that social insurance taxes are going up and the corporate and excise taxes are dropping down? Well, for the corporate tax, the knee-jerk reaction from a lot of people is to say, those companies should pay more. You know, make companies pay. Let's not have individuals pay, let's make companies pay. But we talked about that sort of a fallacy back in the first lecture. Companies don't pay taxes, people pay somehow. When we talk about the corporate tax, what we need to think about is who actually pays the corporate tax. Is it paid by higher prices being charged to consumers? Is it paid by companies hiring fewer workers or paying them lower wages? Or is it paid by investors in those companies? It seems, by and large, that the empirical evidence is that that tax is paid by investors. It reduces the return that investors get when they put their money in companies. Again, we might say, well, you know, let's go get that return. Why have these people getting as high a return? But if the goal of policy is more saving and more investment, and we have all these things in place like individual retirement accounts and 401ks to encourage people to put money aside and save, it seems peculiar at best to then turn around and say, well, let's first try and give away to and get people to have a higher return, and then let's tax them extra on that higher return. You got to make your choices here one way or the other. If you believe in higher savings, then having more taxes on people who invest money is probably not the best way to go. Moreover, an awful lot of those corporate taxes and gains to corporations, the investors in those companies are not just rich people. They're things like pension funds, where your retirement income may be coming from, or funds that are owned broadly, like mutual funds, that are owned in small amounts by a large number of people. So before we're too quick to hop on corporations or to assume that people getting corporate income should definitely pay more, I would suggest that if you want to have the rich pay more, you should focus on having the income tax rates for the rich be higher. That's a straightforward way of doing it. And sort of pretending that when corporate taxes are charged, they don't affect anyone is going to be a peculiar and offbeat kind of way of doing it, where you're penalizing everyone for investing, regardless of whether they're rich or just middle class and saving up money. With excise taxes, there are a lot of proposals out there for much higher cigarette taxes, for higher gasoline taxes, and you don't hear these quite as much, but some people do also talk about higher taxes for alcohol. The argument in all three cases is basically an argument about negative externalities. We say that there are negative externalities from health, for smoking and for things like drunk driving, although in moderate doses it doesn't seem like alcohol is particularly harmful. And with gasoline, we're talking about pollution, air pollution, carbon pollution, possibility of something like the greenhouse warming effect happening. And so if we were to tax those things more, then presumably we would not only get the benefit of the government having more money for taxes and perhaps being able to cut back on some of these other taxes in an offsetting kind of way, but we would also have the advantage of dealing with some of the negative externalities that were out there. Now, of course, that doesn't tell you exactly how high or how low these taxes should be, but I think that most of them could be raised at least a little bit, and I would personally say that the gasoline tax could probably be raised quite a lot. As a share of GDP, if you just look at the individual income tax really hasn't shifted a whole lot in terms of how much money it brings in over time. It seems to be right around 8-9% of GDP year in, year out. So those of us who really sort of feel like, well, you know, government is getting bigger and bigger, it's taking more and more of my money, the way in which it's doing that is it's doing that through social insurance taxes. Those are the growing areas. The other areas just don't seem to be growing in a large way. Now, of course, that's not to say we might not like them to be smaller. We might not like to have some sort of change happen. But the argument that somehow taxes are gobbling us up just doesn't seem accurate on the facts. When we think about the overall balance between taxes and spending, if we have a situation where spending is higher than taxes, then the government needs to get some extra money. After all, it's not collecting enough in taxes to pay for the spending that's scheduled. When the government's running a deficit, then, the government borrows that money from abroad, and it would borrow it, or just borrow it, period, by issuing bonds. And those bonds could be bought by either domestic or foreign investors. On the flip side, if the government runs a surplus, then what the government can do with that surplus is go out and buy back bonds that it issued in the past or bonds that are coming due. And so people who had invested their money in bonds and want to save up money, now, instead of putting that money in federal bonds, need to put it somewhere else in the economy. And the hope would be that they put it maybe in a private industry where you could have more investment income for those companies. So the government, whether it's deficit or surplus, is affecting how much saving is out there in the economy. If the government is running deficits, it's soaking up money. It's absorbing private savings by issuing bonds. If it's running surpluses, then it can be contributing to the overall amount of national saving by pumping more savings out there in the economy. Now, at this point, there's an issue which often comes up and is worth dealing with directly. And that issue is, why are we counting Social Security? Why shouldn't we leave out Social Security? And the argument is, look, Social Security has its own trust fund and its own taxes. Money is coming into Social Security, and then it's going out to people who get it. That shouldn't be counted as part of the federal budget. It should be a separate amount. In fact, since the early 1980s, Social Security has been collecting extra money and building up a surplus. So when we talk about the federal budget, Social Security taxes shouldn't be included in the tax side. Social Security spending shouldn't be included on the spending side. Now, this is an argument which I think is frankly a little bit disingenuous. It usually comes from people who are saying, don't mess with Social Security. I want to take Social Security off the political picture, and I don't want it to come into the discussion when we talk about the federal budget. I don't want it to be used as a way of thinking about balancing the federal budget. Now, that's a perfectly reasonable argument. It's an argument you can make on its own merits. But it's an argument you have to make on its own merits. It's not an argument that you can win by definition, kind of, by saying, well, you just don't count Social Security one way or another. Remember, fiscal policy is overall taxes and overall spending. Overall taxes and spending includes everything. You can't just sort of say, we're going to collect $600 billion taxes, pay it out every year to people out there in Social Security and Medicare spending, and then kind of say, well, it just doesn't count. You know, we're just going to ignore that $600 billion. It just doesn't work. It's too big a category. One analogy that I sometimes think about is, imagine that my wife and I were to say something like, okay, I'm going to take all the income I earn, and I'm going to put it in a retirement account, and we're going to live on the income you earn. Imagine that was our family plan. Well, we put that plan in place. I take all my income, and I put it in the retirement account, and we try and live on my wife's income. And then we find, after a year or two, or probably be more like a month or two, we find, hey, we're having a really hard time paying the bills. We're having a really hard time making expenses meet. And then I say, well, it can't be the retirement plan we've set up, because the retirement money, that's in a whole separate account. So that doesn't affect anything on this other side. I mean, the retirement account is irrelevant. We shouldn't even take it into account. The fact that 100% of my money is going into the retirement account just doesn't make a difference. We should set it aside and ignore it. If I tried to make that argument, you'd say, well, that's just crazy. I mean, the money's coming in, and you're making a decision about where to put it. And the fact that you're making a decision to put some over here causes stresses on the rest of the budget. Now, for exactly that reason, as money comes in for Social Security, as Social Security taxes go up and up, that puts stresses on the rest of the budget. And you can't just say, well, you know, it's a separate trust fund. It's in my left-hand pocket, so I'm going to ignore it when I look at my right-hand pocket. We have to look at all the pockets that are there for the federal budget. We can't just pretend that some things can be sectioned off and ignored. I think that, again, that's not an argument to say that we ought to cut Social Security or we should attack Social Security. It can make perfect sense. I'm a big fan of Social Security. I think it's done a great job of lifting many of the elderly out of poverty. It certainly needs some reform over the next few decades, but heck, there's a lot of stuff out there that needs to be reformed one way or another. So my argument here is not saying that somehow we should slash Social Security or cut it or change it or do whatever. My point is just that you can't get around the fact that it's part of the budget. You can't get around the fact that it is federal taxes and federal spending. You can't get around the fact that its existence has an effect on people's willingness to pay for other programs. Remember, more than half the people in the country, the single biggest tax they have is Social Security. And you can't say that, well, you should just ignore that when making other decisions. It just won't work out that way. Another area that we should spend a little bit of time looking at is the state and local budget. And I don't want to spend a lot of time going into this. We don't really have that time. But it's worth saying that the total state and local spending each year, as we get toward the end of the 90s, is about $1 trillion a year. That's not at all insignificant. Remember, federal spending is about $1.7 trillion. So the state and local spending is about two-thirds of that amount. And that's a significant, sizable chunk. In fact, if you look at the education budget, which is almost all state and local spending, the education budget toward the end of the 90s, if you add up all the state and local districts, is about $350 billion a year. Now, $350 billion a year is bigger than our spending on health and Medicare. It's much bigger than the defense budget or anything like that. It's just not under the control of the federal government, under our system of government. Almost all of the education money is state and local. In fact, I every year I sort of giggle about this as presidential elections come up. It's terribly common to hear presidential candidates, Reagan did this, Bush did this, Clinton did this, they run for office and they talk a lot about how they want to fix education and how they want to fix crime. And those are often two of the really big issues they put out there. You know, we'll fix education, we'll fix crime. And I confess that every time somebody says that to me, my immediate reaction is, you want to fix education or crime? Go be a governor. It's states that do that. It's states that run education spending. It's states that run police protection. If education and crime is really where your heart is, and those are the problems you really want to deal with, those are the problems you see are important, there's no reason to run for president of the United States. In the U.S. system of government, the president just doesn't have very much power over a large amount of money or over controlling either education or crime. So when you hear someone say that, I mean, it's clear those are issues that matter a lot to people. They somehow resonate on the campaign trail. But I find it remarkably silly that somehow Americans respond to that reaction from their politicians. We can also put the U.S. government spending overall, total, that is to say federal, state, local, in a sort of international perspective. In the international perspective, we would say that if we just looked at total U.S. spending, government spending, that is, again, all the different levels together, it's roughly speaking a third of gross domestic product. If you add the $1.7 trillion from the federal level to the $1 trillion at the state and local level, that's $2.7 trillion total out of the $8 trillion GDP in the United States. Now, that one-third of spending is actually, interestingly enough, the lowest of any industrialized country. And in fact, it's a lot lower than most industrialized countries. Only Japan is close to the United States. Most of the countries in Europe have government spending as a share of GDP, which is more in the 45% of GDP, 50% of GDP. Some of the Scandinavian countries even above 50% of GDP. Of course, the mix of government spending in the United States is somewhat different. Our defense budget, for example, tends to be much bigger in the United States than in many of those other countries. So defense spending in the U.S. as a share of GDP tends to be somewhat larger. On the other side, a lot of those countries have socialized or nationalized their healthcare sector. And so for them, all of their healthcare spending takes place inside the government as part of government spending. Whereas for the United States, an awful lot of healthcare spending takes place happening through the private sector and doesn't count as part of government. But even if you throw out healthcare spending, you still find that for the industrialized countries of the world, the U.S. share of spending, government spending as a share of GDP, tends to be much lower. And presumably that represents something in American tradition, something of a sense that we're not going to have our government getting involved in as many things, giving as many subsidies, being involved as actively in the management of all the rest of the economy. Let's shift focus now. I hope at this point you have sort of a sense of the spending and tax sides of the budget. And let's talk about debts and deficits. This is a funny sort of lecture for me to give. For years now, going back to the early 80s, I've been giving lectures on government deficits and how deficits are too big and out of control and need to be reined in, and one argument after another for deficit control. But now, as I stand and give this lecture, it appears the government will have a relatively large budget surplus this year. It moreover appears these surpluses are going to continue into the immediate future. If you look at long-range projections from the Congressional Budget Office and other nonpartisan sources, what you tend to see is that we have either surpluses or, if there are deficits, they're relatively small deficits for about the next 10 years, up until the late part of the first decade of the 21st century. Around about 2010, what you begin to see is that the aging of the American population will kick in. The baby boom generation, all those folks born after World War II, will start turning 65 around 2010, 2015. And the result of that will be that government spending for things like Social Security and Medicare will begin to increase dramatically. So if we look at about 2015 and later, we begin to see big demands for government spending that's already been promised, and not so much in the way of taxes coming in, and a real deficit problem emerging as a result of that. But for the next 10 years, unless something peculiar happens, it really looks like we finally have the deficit issue pretty much under control. Let me try to clarify some terms here. First of all, let's clarify the difference between the budget deficit and the federal debt. When we think about the deficit, what we're really focusing on is 1 year at a time. When you talk about a deficit, you're talking about annual deficits. When you talk about debt, you're talking about the accumulation of those deficits over time. Say, for example, just for the sake of argument, that there was $3.3 trillion in accumulated debt. That is all the money which has been borrowed year in, year out over time. Then, with that $3.3 trillion in debt, in 1 year, the government runs, say, a budget surplus of $100 billion. Now, that surplus would be subtracted from the debt. So the next year, instead of having $3.3 trillion in debt, we'd have $3.2 trillion in debt. Or on the reverse side, let's say we had $3.3 trillion in debt and we ran a $200 billion deficit. Then the debt would increase and we'd be up to $3.5 trillion in debt at the end of the year. So when you think about a government and debt and borrowing, remember that the deficit is 1 year and the debt is the accumulation over time. I think the single most useful thing for looking at the overall indebtedness of the U.S. government, the single most useful factor to look at, is to avoid the 1 year sort of thing, which can bounce up and bounce down in ways that maybe don't tell you much about the long term. And instead look at the total debt accumulated over time as a percentage of gross domestic product. So, of course, if you look at debt accumulated over time as a percentage of gross domestic product, you're kind of adjusting for the size of the economy getting bigger and bigger and bigger over time. What's the pattern there since around World War II? Well, heading into World War II in 1940, the accumulated debt as a percentage of gross domestic product was 44%. However, the U.S. fought World War II on borrowed money, and by 1946, debt divided by GDP was 113%. That is, the accumulated federal debt was bigger than the gross domestic product at that time. However, during the 1950s and 1960s, the U.S. sometimes runs deficits, sometimes runs surpluses, but when it runs deficits, they tend to be pretty small. So if you think about this ratio of debt to gross domestic product, you can think of the debt sometimes getting a little bigger, sometimes getting a little smaller, not changing a heck of a lot. But in the meantime, the GDP, the economy, is steadily growing at that 3% productivity rate a year that we were talking about before. So if you think of the ratio between those two, the numerator isn't changing a heck of a lot, but the denominator is growing steadily over time. So the debt-to-GDP ratio falls. It falls from 113% in 1946, down to 82% in 1950, down to 46% in 1960, down to 28% in 1970, and down to 26% by 1980. So even though the government was running deficits in some of those years, they were relatively small deficits. The growth in the economy tended to be bigger than that amount. And one of the great ironies of the late 20th century, that when the United States elected Ronald Reagan, with Reagan saying, we've been running deficits year in, year out, we can't do this anymore, federal debt is out of control, we really have to change this pattern. When he made that argument in 1980, the debt-to-GDP ratio at 26% was the lowest it had been since before the Great Depression. We did have deficits, they just weren't that huge. So, I would say that if you look at it from the debt-to-GDP ratio, the federal government's borrowing was declining and declining and declining in relation to the size of the economy up until about 1980. At that point, we have a sharp reversal. We start running very large budget deficits in the 1980s, much larger than the growth of the economy, and as a result, we begin to see the debt-to-GDP ratio make a U-turn. Remember, it was 26% in 1980. The debt-to-GDP ratio is up to 37% by 1985, it's up to 44% by 1990, and it's up to 52% by 1995. The deficits we're running for the 1980s and 1990s are not like the little deficits of the 60s and 70s, where the debt-to-GDP ratio could still fall. Now the borrowing is growing faster than the economy. As it grows faster than the economy, the debt-to-GDP ratio starts going up and up. In the late 1990s, with smaller deficits and indeed surpluses emerging, we're seeing that ratio level out and decline again. But that movement in big deficits from 1980 to 1995 really is striking and historically an odd thing for the United States. Now, the first time we've had really enormously large peacetime budget deficits. We'd had them during wartime, but during peacetime it was a different business. So that leaves us with sort of two basic questions. One is, how do we get these really big deficits? And then the other is, what happened to turn it around and get us headed towards surpluses? Well, as with most really big questions, we don't have a simple answer or a straightforward answer. There's not one factor you can look at and pin down and say that was it. But in the early 1980s, we can see a number of things happening. Reagan cuts taxes. So as taxes go down, that tends to make the deficit larger. Defense spending gets a substantial boost between about 1982 and 1986 in particular. Social programs keep growing, like Social Security and spending on health care. And interest payments begin to build on themselves. Interest rates are relatively high during part of this time, and so interest payments start growing. And that helps us produce this large budget deficit through the 1980s. However, as we hit the late 1980s, we begin to move into the 1990s, a different set of factors begin to kick in. Defense spending begins to go down, for example, by about 1988 or so. Defense spending from 1988 to 1998 in real dollars has dropped by about a third. We begin to get these plans from first George Bush in 1990 and then Bill Clinton, once he's elected, to cut the deficit. The economy, after the recession in the early 1990s, becomes healthy. It begins bringing in a lot more tax revenue. And effectively, we've had more or less a spending freeze for quite a while in all those extra small categories of the budget, that stuff which is the remaining 27% of the federal budget. So we've kind of let the extra tax revenue come in, and we really haven't spent the money on other things. That combination of factors has helped us lead us out of the woods, so that by the late 1990s, all of a sudden, we're running small budget surpluses, and with the prospect of more of those surpluses to come in the future. What we want to think about now is, how can we take fiscal policy, these ideas of tax and spending tools, and how can we use them to go after the four goals of macroeconomic policy which we laid out in the previous four lectures? For example, how would we use fiscal policy to go after unemployment? Well, in some cases, we would just be using taxes and spending in various ways we talked about to try and, for example, cushion frictional unemployment and help people to find programs more quickly, to find new jobs more quickly. We could also think about redesigning a lot of our government programs to try and reduce structural unemployment. But those things don't actually change overall spending necessarily in the federal government. In fact, they may increase spending or decrease it depending on the mix of programs. They're really talking about a redesign of existing programs. When most people talk about using fiscal policy to fight unemployment, what they're really talking about is boosting aggregate demand, and boosting aggregate demand in a way to try and get cyclical unemployment down to about zero. For example, if we had a situation where we're in a recession and we really want to go after cyclical unemployment and try and eliminate it, we could have tax cuts or we could have an increase in government spending. Either one of which, the goal would be to try and get more demand out there. If there's more demand, businesses will become more willing to hire, and we can sort of pull ourselves out of the recession we're in. So when you think about fiscal policy can increase consumption spending through tax cuts. It could increase investment spending through tax breaks. It could increase government spending directly just by spending more money. And in all those ways, the aggregate demand side of GDP could be boosted. What about if we use fiscal policy to fight inflation? Well, if you're going to fight inflation with fiscal policy, then we need to think about cutting aggregate demand. We need to think about tax increases, so there would be fewer consumption dollars out there, maybe putting some sort of disadvantage on investment so that people wouldn't be so eager to spend money on investment products, or else cutting government spending directly. In the terms of economists, that policies to fight unemployment would be called expansive or loose fiscal policy, where you're expanding the size of the economy, whereas those policies to fight inflation would be contractionary or tight policy, to contract the economy and try and have a situation where you wouldn't have so many dollars chasing goods. What about if you were thinking about more growth and that was your goal? Well, if you're thinking about more growth, remember that the fundamental goal here is to have more productivity. And to have more productivity, we need to have more savings and thus more capital available for investment. We've already cut the budget deficit pretty much, but by building up budget surpluses to a larger and larger and larger level, we can certainly manage to be in a situation where we would have the government effectively saving money rather than consuming the saving of others. We can also think about various things which might discourage people from consuming. For example, right now, the mortgage on your interest on when you buy a house, the mortgage interest is deductible from your income taxes. That encourages you to spend money on housing. We could take away that tax break. Boy, doesn't that sound unpopular. We could discourage people in a lot of ways from trying to spend money by having higher taxes on things like gasoline, higher things like cigarettes. Some of that sounds pretty darn unpopular too. But it's certainly possible for the government to discourage spending on consumption and thus encourage people to save more in a direct kind of way. What about the trade deficit? Well, remember that when we talk about the trade deficit, what we're really talking about is the dependence of the U.S. economy on foreign capital. The fact that the U.S. has a big trade deficit means we're sucking in capital from abroad. To the extent that we could run larger and larger trade surpluses, we would be more depending on our own capital. We would be more depending on domestic savings. To the extent that we could encourage people not to consume, but instead to save money, either through aggressive things like taxing them for consuming, or perhaps through some kind of policy to force them to save, then we would be in a situation where we could reduce the trade deficit as well, because we would reduce our dependence on foreign capital. So what we begin to see here are some of the issues that are always going to come up in foreign policy, or in fiscal policy. The grave difficulty with thinking about unemployment and inflation is that, as should be apparent from when we talked about them just a moment ago, those two policies run flatly in opposite directions. The policies which are there to try and reduce cyclical unemployment and pump up the economy are exactly the opposite of the policies that we need to fight inflation. So the theory here, and the theory is tricky, would be to say, okay, let's think about when the economy is in danger of inflation, we'll slow it down, and when the economy is in, unemployment is a big problem, we'll try and speed things up. You run into a number of difficulties when we do this kind of policy. This kind of policy goes under the name of counter-cyclical policy. You're running against the cycles of the economy. One grave difficulty is a problem of timing. Think about this for a moment. The federal budget is produced by the president puts out a draft of it in January or February. It must be written the previous fall, like in November and December. So that budget is written and proposed. Then it goes to Congress, and Congress kicks it around and argues over it all summer, and eventually passes a budget by about August of that year. And then the budget itself actually kicks in the following fall and runs through the following year. Now, think about the timing problem here. What that really means is, if you're thinking about focusing on unemployment or focusing on inflation, you have to make that decision way early. You make that decision when the president has to make it, November or December of one year. It's going to be a whole year before the budget is really in place, and it's not until the following year that it's really going to kick in. At that point, it might not be that the same problem is in place. Inflation might be your big worry one year, but 18 months later, it might not be such a big worry anymore. So a big problem with thinking about fiscal policy and using it in these counter-cyclical ways is that the timing lags are very large. The timing lags are, in fact, so large that you can't be altogether sure of what you're trying to accomplish. Moreover, when you think about this issue of extra demand and pumping up the economy, there are going to be a lot of issues that kick in which are going to be somewhat worrisome. For example, imagine that you have a tax cut in order to boost consumption and stimulate the economy. Well, when you have that tax cut, you may also create a budget deficit. As you create a budget deficit, you're sucking in money from the rest of the economy, sucking in savings, and there will be less to invest. This is called the crowding out effect, that as the government borrows more and more money, there's less and less money available for private investment. Private investment is crowded out. So you try and stimulate the economy by boosting consumption, but what you're actually doing is depressing investment. If those two factors kind of balance out, then your tax cut isn't going to have the effect you want. You may also find that as you increase demand, a lot of that extra demand goes into buying imported products. So instead of stimulating the U.S. economy, your tax cut is stimulating the German economy or the Japanese economy. You may also find that as you try and stimulate the U.S. economy with tax cuts, the extra money goes into higher prices. You end up with too many dollars chasing too few goods. So instead of stimulating the economy in the real sense, more goods, you end up just stimulating the inflation level instead. So all of these side effects start kicking in with fiscal policy. It becomes difficult when you think about stimulating the economy to think, what is it am I stimulating here? I'm trying to stimulate consumer spending, but maybe I'm depressing investment and causing more imports and causing more inflation, and the effect may not be really what you wanted at all. There are also grave political difficulties with thinking about this countercyclical behavior. Think about it for a moment. When the economy is really in good shape, it's really humming along, you've got big surpluses, like the U.S. economy has toward the later part of the 90s, or at least moderate-sized surpluses, what does this advice say? This advice says, hey, your economy's humming along really well, you should try and have even bigger surpluses. You should try and make sure the economy doesn't tip over into having too many dollars chasing too few goods. So when the economy is going really, really well, that's the time to raise taxes. That's the time to have the government spend less. Boy, that's a hard sell. Conversely, if the economy is doing really badly and unemployment is being going up and up, you say, well, heck, that's the time the federal government needs to get out there and spend like a drunken sailor. That's difficult, although it's a lot easier sell, because so many congressmen say, times are tough, we need to tighten our belts. But the whole advice here of countercyclical fiscal policy is that the government needs to lean against the economy. In bad times, the government needs to spend generously to stimulate things, and in good times, the government needs to lean against things, take away the punch bowl from the party, try and prevent inflation from getting started. That idea of trying to run fiscal policy to stimulate the economy and go against the economy and make timing all work out, make sure there aren't any side effects, and make it all work politically seems to a lot of economists like you're just asking too much. And I'd say that in the 1990s, a lot of economists have come to believe that fiscal policy is just not all that useful for this kind of short-term management of the economy, trying to fight unemployment, fight inflation. Instead, a lot of economists would argue that those sorts of short-term goals, moving the economy back and forth, are better served by monetary policy, which we'll start off talking about in the next lecture. Instead, we can think of some sort of a division of labor here. We would say that what we really want to use fiscal policy for is to focus on these long-term growth issues. We really want to use fiscal policy to increase national savings. By increasing national savings, try and increase our growth rate from that 1% up more toward 3% a year. As we do that, and as we become more reliant on our own domestic savings, we would expect the budget deficit to come down as well. And so as we build up larger and larger budget surpluses, we expect the trade deficit to diminish. We won't have so much dependence on foreign capital. In effect, the result seems to be that we think of fiscal policy as a long-term investment. We think about it as making long-term investments in a long-term savings rate for the U.S. economy. And we step back and no longer think about fiscal policy as the primary tool for dealing with cyclical unemployment and with inflation.